with support from the Climate Kick Alumni Association. Welcome to The Elephant. I'm Kevin Caners.
This will change the Great Barrier Reef forever. We're seeing huge levels of bleaching in the northern 1,000-kilometer stretch of the Great Barrier Reef.
The sheer scale of coral bleaching is revealed in footage shot for a scientific survey last week. For over 1,000 kilometres from Cairns to the Torres Strait, the once colourful ribbons of reef are a ghostly white. Leading this expedition is one of Australia's...
That's a clip from a recent ABC News report on the bleaching occurring right now on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, where, according to aerial surveys, a staggering 93% of the reefs have been hit by bleaching. According to scientists, this episode is by far the worst that has ever happened in recorded history. And these bleaching events mean vast portions of the coral reefs will die.
Now, I wouldn't like to estimate how much of the total Great Barrier Reef we're going to lose in this event, but I think it's going to be heartbreakingly high.
And it's not just the Great Barrier Reef that's bleaching right now. Coral reefs worldwide are being hit by similar events. Probably only a small number of us have ever had the chance to see coral reefs close up in person. But almost all of us, I would wager, have at least seen snippets from nature documentaries, where we see the incredible colors and abundance of coral reef habitats, how they support an almost unimaginable diversity of fishes, plants, and marine species of all sizes and shapes. They're truly one of the most amazing ecosystems on Earth, and they're so important that at least one-third of all species in the ocean at least partly depend on them. Coral bleaching occurs when water temperatures become abnormally hot for long periods of time. And what's happening right now with reefs worldwide is directly connected to climate change. Scientists have long been warning us, for more than two decades, that damages to our oceans and the death of coral reefs worldwide would likely be the first tipping points that we would experience because of climate change. And after years of ignoring them, we're now starting to see those warnings come to fruition. My guest today is Professor Justin Marshall of the University of Queensland. He's the founder of the nonprofit Coral Watch and the co-author of the book Coral Reefs and Climate Change. And for Professor Marshall and the other scientists whose work revolves around studying the reefs, what's happening right now is no less than heartbreaking.
I'm personally devastated by the whole thing. I'm studying a dying system, and that's very depressing. It's not where I wanted to be. It's not what I wanted to hand on to my children.
And perhaps what's even sadder about this whole event, given that this die-off is directly connected with climate change, is that while this bleaching event is going on, the Australian government is moving forward with plans to allow the development in Queensland of what will be, if built, the world's largest coal mine.
This coal mine will have an area the same size as Ireland. It will emit as much carbon as a small country. It will knock the final nails in the coffin of the Great Barrier Reef, undoubtedly. And it will contribute to killing other reefs worldwide.
Here's my conversation with Professor Justin Marshall. I reached him by phone in Brisbane. Well, Justin Marshall, welcome to The Elephant. I want to get to what's going on right now with the coral reefs and how it's connected to climate change. But first, for those of us who've never seen coral reefs close up, I was wondering if you could tell us what it's actually like when they're healthy to experience them, to dive with them. What do you see? What's it like?
Sure. It is an amazing environment. It's the most diverse and colourful environment on the planet. We think of forests and rainforests being full of colourful birds and colourful animals. In fact, even a rainforest is it's green and brown and lovely, and there's flowers, but there's only a few birds here and there. One of the things that really sets reefs apart is that in a very small area, there's a tremendous number of living organisms. Many of them are very colourful, and those colours actually help them survive. So really, it's the most colourful and vibrant habitat on the planet.
Do you remember the first time that you saw coral reefs close up?
I do. I was 5 or 6, I think. I was clinging to my father's back as he set out across the reef, and I was terrified. I looked down and I could see big fish, or you know, what I thought were big fish. They, I have no idea what size they were, probably half a meter long or something. And I could see all this rocky, colorful stuff. So I stuck my face in the water, then out again and in and out. And after a while, I just had my face in the water and glued to what was going on, because there was so much going on. I mean, it's one of the big surprises when people start to dive or snorkel. You stand above the water and there is this surface in front of you. But then as soon as you put your head under the surface and become comfortable with breathing, either through the snorkel tube or through the aqualung, what's underwater is really mind-blowing in terms of its diversity.
And so was it an instant affinity for you that you got to love the coral?
I think so. I mean, I sometimes say I've been a marine biologist since I was two. I was lucky enough to have parents who were marine scientists, and they went around the world and took me with them, and there's always been bottles of pickled fish in the house. My mother was a natural history illustrator, so she would paint the fish that my father studied. So it's just as if I've always been in a fish tank my entire life. So yes, it was natural for me to want to get out there and understand what was there in more detail, and I've been doing it ever since.
So when we hear about coral reefs and like the Great Barrier Reef, I think most of us don't really, we understand that it's this rich habitat, but we're not quite sure what it is in some regards. What is coral?
Well, coral is, it's with the Great Barrier Reef, for instance, it's the largest living structure on the planet. It's viewable from space. Coral itself is actually a single coral polyp or a single organism is quite small. So it's remarkable that these small animals have managed to build such a structure. Now, individually, a polyp is a little bit like an upside-down jellyfish, or it's a little bit like a small anemone. So it's one of the animals which construct its body mainly from gelatinous-like material. However, coral has managed to settle out on the bottom and work out a way to extract calcium carbonate from the water. So it then builds a skeleton within which it can live. So what we see when we go into a shop, for instance, and there is, let's say, jewelry draped over a beautiful coral skeleton, what we're seeing there is a dried out and probably bleached white skeleton of the coral. So it's the calcium carbonate that the polyps leave behind. Each one of those coral heads contains hundreds or thousands of individual polyps. So it's a community of animals that live together. And the different coral species have built these coral reefs around the world, of which the Great Barrier Reef is the biggest. So it's remarkable that they've managed to do this in such a short space of time.
And so are the polyps completely stationary then?
Most of them are. There are a few, the fungids, the fungus-like corals, which can move around a little bit. But most of them are essentially glued to the substrate. In fact, that's what they do. They fasten themselves to the substrate when the coral larva settles out on the reef. And they then grow and look a bit like a plant. So someone looking out over a coral reef might be forgiven for thinking that what they're seeing are beautiful branches of some sort of underwater plant. And they take on different forms. There are branching forms. There are forms that fan out in plates, look a bit like some big leaves or something. So again, a naive observer, someone going to the reef for the first time, might think these are all plants. In fact, they're these colonial animals, which also, like plants, take advantage of the sunlight.
So what's happening right now?
Right now, unfortunately, we're in the middle of the third world coral reef bleach, and certainly the worst massive reef bleach that we've seen ever. Now, these bleaching events have only started since about 20 years ago. The first one was in 1998. In that year, because of the bleach and because of the stress that the coral was put under, we lost around 16% of all reefs worldwide. The bleach that we're seeing right now, it will take some time to work out similar figures, but I believe, and my other coral scientist colleagues also believe, that it will be the worst bleach we've seen. It's certainly the longest bleach that we've seen. And that means that corals are now dying off at an alarming rate. Certainly in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef, I think we've already lost half of that large section of reef.
And so what is bleaching? What's actually going on?
Yeah, what's going on there? So It's called bleaching because when you look at a coral, it turns white. It looks as if it's been bleached. Now, a healthy coral, a healthy colony of corals or a healthy reef actually looks mostly brown and green. So if you look on a reef, it's quite rare to see bright colors. The bright colors are provided by the sponges, a few of the corals, and many of the fish and other animals that live there. But a healthy reef is a little bit like a forest. It looks green. And it's actually green for the same reason that a forest is green. So forests are green because the plants have chlorophyll. They have chloroplasts within the cells. And these organelles manage to trap sunlight, to use air, and to make carbohydrates from the carbon dioxide in air and a mechanism of photosynthesis. Coral, although it's an animal, takes on board little algal cells, so little plant-like cells within their tissues, and they form a symbiotic relationship, so-called, where the algae provides the coral with nutrients through photosynthesis, and the coral provides the algae with protein from feeding on zooplankton and protection. This is a relationship that's been going on for thousands of years. It's very successful. But when coral bleaches, for a number of reasons, those symbiotic algae either break down, die, or are expelled. And that means that the green and brown veil of algae, if you like, that lies over the coral is taken away. And what we see is either very bright white or sometimes beautiful fluorescent colors, so really day glow colors, which are the colors of the polyp in the background coming out. So the coral loses its symbiont, becomes highly stressed, bleaches, so-called, and may then either die off, depending on how stressed it's been, or embark on a long road to recovery and regrowing its symbiotic algae.
And so the coral can't survive on its own. It needs the symbiotic relationship.
That's right. I mean, there are a few deep water corals that don't have this relationship, and they do survive on their own. But the surface living corals up in the surface waters can't survive on their own for long. They need the symbiont to provide them with nutrients and energy. And if they can't regrow them, if they can't re-sequester them from the water, then yes, they die and they get covered in a competitive mat of algae. So the larger algae on the reef, the larger seaweeds, essentially. Seaweed takes over the reef. So you end up with a reef that's no longer corals, but a reef which is a comparative ugly, not so pretty reef of seaweed.
And so is this bleaching, does it happen directly because of temperatures in the water?
Yeah, that's right. Bleaching happens when coral becomes too hot for too long. Now, because of the ocean is tidal, and sometimes coral is exposed to the air, and sometimes rock pools that you find coral in can heat up a lot. So coral can put up with high temperature for a short space of time under these conditions. However, when the temperature rises too high for too long, and that rise may only be 1 or 2 degrees different, then the coral becomes stressed and it loses its symbiont and it bleaches. And this rise in temperature is being driven by carbon emissions. So global warming, so-called, is what's responsible for the coral bleaches that we've seen for the last 20 years.
And how do we know it's global warming? I mean, this is an El Nino year, which has gotten a lot of attention. Why do we know it's not just that?
That's a good question, and it's definitely associated with El Nino. So the fact that tells us it's not just a natural El Nino fluctuation is that El Ninos have been happening for thousands of years. I'm not sure what the age of the current weather cycles are on Earth, but these have been going on for many years. As you say, they're natural. Every 7 years or so, there's a reversal in world temperature. Some areas stay hot for longer. But we've only been seeing mass coral bleaching of the sort that we're seeing now for 20 years. They correlate extremely strongly with the increase in global temperatures. And they do fall often on El Nino years because you get an additive effect. So there is the underlying effect of global warming. Then when there's an El Nino on top of that, the coral bleaches. But the bleaches we're seeing are definitely not just caused by El Nino, and many people try and use that as an excuse. That is not the case. It is undoubtedly correlated to anthropogenic or anthropocentric, you know, man-made temperature increases on the planet.
And so I know you mentioned some numbers before, but so what is the scale of the current die-off? You say this is the biggest bleaching event that we know of?
Yeah, it is. I'll give you some numbers for the Great Barrier Reef first. So, the Great Barrier Reef is around 3,000 kilometers long. And it's this huge structure the size of Italy, essentially, that stretches down the side of the eastern, northeastern side of Australia. The top third of that reef has bleached extremely heavily. Probably 95% of the reefs, or the corals on those reefs, have bleached. What we're seeing now, as the temperature of the water has decreased, is we're seeing whether or not those corals are recovering. And current estimates are that probably less than 50% of those corals will recover because of the severity of the bleach in that area. This is a great shame because that area of the reef was the least touched. It's the most remote. There are not many towns up and down the coast there. There's comparatively little shipping. Previous activities have been quite reduced in that area. The southern two-thirds of the Great Barrier Reef has also bleached to some extent, but less so. So, for instance, I went out to the reef last weekend to an area that was only 50% bleached. But again, you hear news reports that the bottom two-thirds of the Great Barrier Reef is fine. Unfortunately, it's not. It's still highly stressed. It's still bleaching, but just less so. So, I wouldn't like to estimate how much of the total Great Barrier Reef we're going to lose in this event, but I think it's going to be heartbreakingly high. But then let's not forget, this is not just the Great Barrier Reef. In fact, most of the coral reefs around the world are bleaching now. It is a global event. Some reefs have bleached 2 years in a row. In the Caribbean, for instance, some reefs are just beginning to bleach. The coral triangle reefs in Indonesia, which are the world's best and best preserved, most biodiverse reefs, are beginning to bleach now. So this is a global phenomenon. It's not something confined to Australia. And that, again, underlies the fact that as a global community, we need to move to renewable energy as fast as possible, much faster than we're saying we're going to. We need to stop burning fossil fuels. We need to stop emitting carbon into the atmosphere. Otherwise, the future that we're looking at is no reef within 40 years.
You said you saw them up close in the southern portion?
I went out to the reef, in fact, with our state of Queensland Environment Minister last weekend and snorkeled on the reef, saw the corals up close. 3 weeks before that, I spent 10 days up on Lizard Island, which is a beautiful spot in the northern section of the reef with a research station run by the Australian Museum. And that's when I began to become really concerned, because I, amongst others, noticed this 95% bleach of the reefs. I sent back many photographs. I have a Dropbox site, which anyone is welcome to go to if they want to see and witness what's going on there. And we can provide more information through a citizen science group that I run called Coral Watch. So it's www.coralwatch, all one word, .org. If anyone's interested, go there and we can provide more information. But yes, I've seen this up close in person, and I'm personally devastated by the whole thing. I've worked on reefs for 30 years, and I'm basically looking at the end of my career very soon.
Because of the die-off, or because you're going to retire?
Because of the die-off. Now, I've got another 20 years ahead of me. I guess I'll spend the next 20 years doing my best to encourage people to do better in terms of environmental stewardship and studying the remaining animals, but I'm studying a dying system. And that's very depressing. It's not where I wanted to be. It's not what I wanted to hand on to my children. I have two kids. I take them to the reef. We've been there. We've been to Lizard Island before, and it was a wonderful place. Right now, if I took my kids there, I would be ashamed to show them what's going on.
You recently accompanied David Attenborough on, as he filmed his latest series on the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah.
Was it being damaged then too? Was the bleaching already occurring?
No, the bleaching wasn't happening then. So that was, you know, the series has just screened in some countries. It's actually just screening in Australia right now. It's we had episode one on Sunday. It's a 3-episode series. It was a great privilege. It was wonderful to work with Sir David Attenborough, who is one of the world's best communicators of nature. He's been doing this for over 60 years. He was visiting the reef again after diving there for the first time 60 years ago. And we took him down in a submersible. I was his guide for some of that journey. We went in the submersible together, and we visited reefs in and around Lizard Island and in and around the Great Barrier Reef. And the reef then was still beautiful. There were some areas that were impacted by recent cyclones and other recent bleaches, and that was obvious, perhaps, to the trained eyes of the marine scientists. But we certainly managed to film beautiful life, and Sir David and his team, Atlantic Productions, did a great job of showing the world the wonderful side of the great of reef systems and the life that lives there. It's unfortunately a fact that most of the corals and most of the reef that I showed Sir David is now dead or dying. So what we have there is a history lesson, not a natural history lesson. So when you watch that documentary series, a lot of what you see on the television is not there anymore.
I mean, you mentioned how tough it is for you to see this thing you've spent your entire life working on dying. I guess, what is it like for you and your colleagues in general?
It's the same. I've got part of my team, my lab is up there at the moment, 6 people up there studying fish and trying to come to grips with the fact that the fish population is going to die off as well. They were watching the reef yesterday. They're in tears. They're sending back reports of an eerie reef full of no life. We're all basically crying about it. It's a deeply upsetting experience.
Would you say we should be angry about this or sad?
Well, both. I mean, it is, for me, it's a grieving process. I've gone through, I go through sad every day. I'm deeply angry. I'm very angry that this is something which we've been predicting, reporting for over 20 years. 30 years for some of us have been saying reefs are in trouble. We need to do something about it. As scientists, we say this over and over again. It's reported in the press, briefly, and people go, oh, there's a problem, and then it's on to the next thing. It's, the football match is more important. We've been sometimes screaming about this to local politicians. We've said it to, the Australian federal government over and over again, and as I'm sure many people listening to this will remember, finally, last year in Paris, many countries, over 190 countries, I think, agreed that, yes, there is a problem in terms of man-made global climate change, and we need to do something about that. Unfortunately, what the Australian government then did was come back to Australia with a very poor emissions commitment, and secondly, open the world's largest, or sign papers to open the world's largest coal mine in Queensland, right next door to the Great Barrier Reef. This coal mine will have an area the same size as Ireland in Great Britain. It will emit as much carbon as a small country. It will finally knock the final nails in the coffin of the Great Barrier Reef, undoubtedly, both for local and global reasons. And moreover, it will contribute to killing other reefs worldwide. When we sell carbon to other countries, when we sell coal to other countries, we must not forget this is a global problem. It doesn't just go out of the country and disappear from here. We cannot think that we're somehow passing that on to someone else as a problem. We are a global community. We need to act more like a global community. And I would certainly encourage our federal government, first of all, to admit this is an environmental crisis. They haven't done that yet. But secondly, to move towards renewable energy much faster than they are doing.
You said you saw the reefs with Greg Hunt, the environmental, the Minister of the Environment.
Not Greg Hunt. So Greg Hunt is the federal minister. We have state ministers as well. So Stephen Miles is the state, Queensland state Minister for the Environment. I would say, without putting words in his mouth, that he is in a difficult position. His state government has signed papers to open this mine. The federal government has signed papers to open the mine. Having spoken to him, I know that he is very concerned about many aspects of the environment in Queensland, and I know that he is very concerned about the reef in particular. So he's struggling to work out ways or to work on ways in which to deal with this in a political environment, which I don't think he fully agrees with.
Well, I'd like to ask you about Greg Hunt anyways, because I saw a couple news clips. There was one that you were in on that was on ABC where you and the other scientists are saying this is devastating. And he seems pretty optimistic. He says, we think it can recover and a lot of it is okay. So what do you make of his position?
It's completely incorrect. And it's based on advice or facts which are incorrect. And it's actually very insulting to the Australian people, I think, that he hasn't taken on board the full depth of what's going on. And maybe he does believe that there's a small number of scientists who are jumping up and down and trying to make a big thing out of a small thing, but I'm afraid that's not the case. And as more and more facts and figures come out, he needs to accept that this is much greater than he might have already thought. Some of the statements he's made about the southern two-thirds of the reef being fine, as I mentioned before, are incorrect. It's not fine. It is bleaching. I was there just a few days ago. It's better. It's definitely better than the northern third. And that's fortunate for the tourism operators, because many of the tourism sites that many people from Germany come to the Great Barrier Reef, many of the sites that they visit are still okay. They're not as wonderful as they were 30 years ago when I first visited. But, let's not say in this interview that the Great Barrier Reef is still not worth visiting. It is absolutely worth visiting. And Greg Hunt is correct in saying that. So the reef is definitely a great tourist site still. But if we continue to insult it as we are doing so, and if his government doesn't get their act together much faster than they're doing, that Great Barrier Reef is going to disappear, possibly within my lifetime. One of the things that talks to these guys is the fact that our tourism industry here in Queensland is a $6 billion industry every year, and it has 70,000 jobs riding on the reef in various aspects. So those are the sorts of things he needs to start thinking about when he opens his mouth and comes out with facts and figures that are bluntly incorrect.
And so is the federal government in favor of this new gigantic coal mine?
Absolutely. I mean, for them, it's all about jobs, immediate jobs and immediate profit. I'm not sure who's driving it, whether it's them or particularly the Queensland government, who are, again, very concerned with jobs. Now, these are the sorts of things that politicians think about, because it wins them votes. Are we going to get some new jobs? Yes, we are. That means we'll get some new votes. Well, stack up the figures here. So that mine, they predict, will employ 5,000 people. As I just mentioned, there were 70,000 jobs riding on reef tourism in Queensland. So are they really willing to gamble a few thousand jobs against tens of thousands of jobs? This doesn't make sense to me. Look at the profit from that mine is predicted to be $4 billion a year or something like that. I'm not certain of the figures, but tourism is certainly closer to $6 billion. They seem to be taking a great gamble. They're basing this gamble on facts that they don't understand and that they misquote and misrepresent. So they need to take a step backwards and think harder about their policies and what they're pushing through. Because what they're pushing through right now is certain death for the Great Barrier Reef.
So what do you think accounts for this cognitive dissonance? Because, if we're to take seriously what, even the Australian government committed to in Paris, let alone all the other governments, it's clear that, to build new coal mines is madness. We need to be getting off coal as soon as possible if we're to have any chance of staying under 2 degrees.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting question. It's one that I think was discussed in detail in Paris. There is a dissonance. There's a disconnect. There is a lack of understanding, or I think, of the urgency which we need to act with. And a number of people said that the Paris meeting was both a tremendous triumph, but also a tremendous failure. It was a triumph because, finally the world did agree that we were going to do something. It was a failure because we did not agree to do enough. And one of the great dangers of that Paris meeting is that it sent a signal to the world that okay, the politicians now have this in hand and we can sit back and wait for the right thing to happen. As has clearly been demonstrated in Australia since then, we cannot. And the real hard work started as soon as that Paris meeting was finished. And that's certainly the case here. It's really difficult to make the federal government here understand that we are right in the middle of an environmental crisis. Again, they haven't admitted that yet. And we need to get off coal sooner than as soon as possible. I have many German colleagues. I've been to Germany a number of times. I have tremendous admiration for what the German people are trying to do in terms of renewable energy. Now, individual houses have a number of different solutions. There are subsidies for these, which in Australia are very slow to come through. We put solar panels on our house in the year that the subsidies for solar panels were removed. So the government here is really not serious about renewable energy. They'd like to think they are. They put some money into it. But when you stack that up against their seriousness in terms of selling coal to other countries, it's just, as you say, there's a dissonance. There's a disconnect. There's an urgency which they don't seem to realize.
And do you think that's reflected in the general public in Australia too? Do you think the general public has more of a sense of the urgency?
I think they do. I mean, Australian public are actually very connected to their environment. Australians love to go camping. They love to be outside. It's a great outdoor nation. They love the environment. And I think many people do recognize that there is a problem. You know, most Australians, I think if you said, you know, do you know about climate change, they'd say yes. And they'd probably be able to provide a pretty good description of what's going on. I'm not sure, again, that they recognize the urgency with which I think that we need to act. I think that's really come through in this reef bleach. A number of people have called reefs, you know, the canary in the coal mine. Now, that expression means, you know, it's an early warning system. It's a way of warning the planet that something's going on. And reefs, because they are one of the ecosystems that suffers first, seem to be this early warning system. The system has been going off for 20 years at least. We don't seem to be taking that warning on board. So I'm not sure how to get through to the public the urgency of what's going on, but certainly the misinformation that we get from the federal politicians here and the misinformation that is driven through the mainstream press in Australia for a variety of reasons is certainly not helping in swaying the public one way or the other. So, you know, although Australians are very concerned about their environment, I'm not sure that, let's say, that they're concerned enough.
You know, one of the things that one often hears if you're trying to communicate climate change, or advice that scientists get, is, you know, don't scare people. Don't be too doomsday about it, because that will lead to people feeling paralyzed and like it's too late.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how you feel about that, or if that's like a difficult position to be in, because this is what we're experiencing now is, as you say, it's devastating. It's dying. One of the great structures on Earth is dying. So I'm wondering how you deal with that.
It should never be doom and gloom. I mean, it's a phrase used by essentially the denialists and the people that want to label scientists that come forward with information as bad. Now, we're labeled doom and gloom, and isn't this terrible? It's all doomsday, and, you know, all the messages we get from the scientists are doom, and just ignore them and hope it goes away. That's very irresponsible. It's a sort of name-throwing exercise. Now, think about a forest. We see forests cut down. We see forests scraped off the surface of the planet. If we stop doing that and replant the forest, it will come back. These plants, these animals, coral reefs in particular, are tremendously resilient. And if we were to suddenly stop tomorrow doing what we're doing, which is bad, and do things which are good, they will come back. And they'll come back rapidly. I would say that if we could stop global warming tomorrow, if we had no more reef bleaches, if we did all of the local things at a local level, which are nice to the reef, then the Great Barrier Reef would be back to a very high level of diversity within decades. And in terms of, you know, a structure, that it's very rapid. So it's not all doom and gloom. There are facts there. But if we don't act on those facts, the doom and the gloom will get worse. So, the real doom and gloom people are the people that refuse to act the people that are calling us names, they are the harbingers of this doom. It is in their hands. We're the people providing the information, providing the advice, and providing the optimism in the end. We're the people saying, let's stop doing it, and we'll help the reef get better. As scientists, there's a number of things we can do potentially to help that process along. So, you know, no, I push back against the label of doom and gloom. I think that, in a way, belongs to the other people. Reefs will come back if we give them a chance.
Just to play devil's advocate, you know, most of us who don't live in Australia or the tropics will spend our lives and we'll never see a coral reef close up. So I was wondering, for those of us who will never be anywhere close to one, why should we care? Why does this have greater importance? And the part that's worst off, as you say, is very far away from human civilization. There's only a few towns close by. Yeah. So why should we care?
So the part of the Great Barrier Reef, which is worst off, is, as I mentioned, is far away. And yes, you know, if that dies tomorrow, it's a great shame. Does it really matter? There are sort of two levels on this. So though, you know, those people that never get to see a reef, they may still experience the wonder of the reef and, you know, rejoice in the fact that nature is beautiful. You know, you could say the same thing about there are some people that will never get to see a forest or never get to see a savanna or never get to see, you know, Africa, those places where there's lots of wonderful nature. They still get to see it on television. They still get, you know, David Attenborough documentaries in front of them. And if those environments disappear, then the documentaries disappear too. That's a very superficial level. And if you drill down into what coral reefs actually mean for the planet, it becomes very rapidly very alarming. So it's a fact that one third of all marine species, not just those we associate with the reef normally, but a third of all marine species spend some of their time, some of their life cycle on or around a coral reef. This includes many of the world's major fisheries. Several of the countries which now have reefs that are starting to bleach, like Indonesia, the Philippines, those areas elsewhere in the Pacific, the Caribbean, those countries rely on reef as a primary source of protein. So it's like a farm. Indonesia, for instance, I believe extracts 60% of the protein eaten by that country from its reef systems. They are deeply worried by what's going on. If they lose their reefs, they're going to somehow have to feed their people from other sources of protein. This is one of the reasons that Australia is seeing increasing numbers of people arriving here by boat. They're beginning to leave what they perceive of as being potentially overcrowded and starving countries. So this is not just a thing that we can sit back and say, oh, it's a shame it's going, but you know, it's something a long way away and it doesn't matter. It affects every one of us. If we want fish on our table in a town in Germany in 10 years' time, we need to look after the reef. If we don't want to have huge migrations of people leaving countries that have lost their reefs to other places in the world, and, you know, we know very well in Australia that Europe right now is struggling to deal with refugees. This problem will get worse, not just through war, but through famine. And it's a famine that we drive through not looking after reef systems.
So I'd be curious to get your thoughts then, like, if we are concerned about the reef, or we're concerned about what's going on in general, what do you generally advise to people?
Two things. I mean, the reef, and people often get confused by now, what is actually killing the reef? Well, there are these two factors. There are the global factors, which we've just talked about, the temperature increase, ocean acidification is another problem. And then there are the local problems, which include too much shipping, poor farming practice next to reef systems. And basically, we need to do better on both levels. We need to look after reefs in as many possible ways that we can. Right now, we have a hospital patient. We have a patient in a bed in a hospital that is bleeding to death. What we must not do is walk into the hospital and beat the patient with a stick. What we must do is walk into the hospital and feed the patient, encourage it to thrive as much as possible. So, you know, in response to your question, that's what we've got to do. We've got to act responsibly at a local and global level in order to encourage this ecosystem to bounce back, as it will if we're nice to it. if we continue to either ignore it because reefs are not our concern, they're a nice thing to see on TV, we're going to be bitten in the behind eventually, because, as I mentioned, reefs are the source of much of the life in the ocean. They're the source of much of the protein for many countries. So it's not just something which is to do with a documentary, which is nice to look at. It has to do with our responsibility for the rest of the world.
What do you think the prognosis is for someone like your son to be able to experience the reef into his adulthood?
Poor. In fact, if you look at the prognosis for the reef, there's a report put out by the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, was put out a few years ago. The word that was used was poor. I was deeply upset. My son is now 12. 6 years ago, when he was six, he looked at me and said, "Daddy, is the reef dying?" I had to say, "Well, yes." No, I started crying. "Yes, it is, Ben, and you know, here's why." And this is one message that we need to give to our children. You know, it is dying. It's dying because we have not been good guardians of the environment. And, you know, give us your help. What are your thoughts? How can we do better? And I really hope that the younger generations coming through act faster than we have. You know, as an adult, as an over 50-year-old, I've got to take some responsibility for not acting fast enough. Now, I've been trying in my own little way, but perhaps I haven't been trying hard enough. Barack Obama, the President of the United States, sat with Sir David Attenborough on David's 89th birthday, and they talked about a number of things. One of the things they talked about at length was that they both wanted their grandchildren to have the opportunity to visit a reef system somewhere, and how much they hope that the world will act very fast to enable that to be the case. At the moment, my prognosis is that it will be poor. I think we're going to struggle to find reef systems for our kids to go to. And, you know, let's sit back in a year's time and see how much of the world's reefs we've lost in this 1 year, in this probably worst global reef breach that we've ever seen, and reflect on that and do better. You know, maybe by the time their children get to go to a reef, it will be on the rise. But as I said earlier, you know, I would have been utterly ashamed to take my son to the reef 2 weeks ago when I went there and show him the way in which those corals are dying and growing seaweed all over the top of them, the almost bewildered expressions on the faces of the fish as their homes and their food disappears. We're destroying one of the most beautiful things on the planet, and we're just not doing enough about it.
What do you see your job as now going forward? I mean, as you say, this is forcing you to have a different job. Essentially,
yes. You know, I've spent the last month of my life doing something that I shouldn't have needed to do. And I run this citizen science organization called Coral Watch, in which we encourage anyone to get out there. We have a system where, you know, non-scientists can go out. They can help us monitor the reefs. We can get as many people as possible out there returning real data using pre-calibrated systems. The thing I'd like most of all is for Coral Watch to disappear. The thing I'd like most of all is for these monitoring systems to not need to be there. We don't need to monitor the reef because it's a wonderful system, in the same way as we don't need to monitor many of the forests around the world because it's there, they're there, and they're flourishing. So my job at the moment is twofold. I study animals on the reef. I spent a lifetime doing that. I actually study their visual systems and what they actually see primarily. But my job has also become a guardian of the reef. I was one of the first people, I think, to shout loudly about this latest bleaching event. And it's unfortunate that I have to do that, and I have to continue to do that until people begin to sit up and listen to it. So for any of your listeners out there, if you can help spread the word, that helps. You know, talk to people who don't agree. One of the problems that I face as a scientist is we get together at conferences and we all agree there's a problem. We then go home and we've agreed that there's a problem, but we haven't really done anything about it. So it's important to talk to those people that don't agree, those people that will say it's more important to have a mine and we've got prosperity based on that mine. You know, a number of the people up in northern Queensland want this mine, and I totally understand that because it will bring prosperity to their region. There have been headlines in the paper such as, you know, "My children can't eat coral." That's absolutely true, but my children can't eat coal. Now, how do we resolve this problem of some wanting prosperity through mining, some wanting prosperity through tourism in the reef? For me, because mining is such a short-lived thing, because it's actually destroying the atmosphere, it's a no-brainer. But it's very difficult to talk about these problems and get to a point where we all agree and move forward.
What's the outlook on stopping the mine now? Some permits have been approved. So where is it currently at?
As I understand it, yes, you're right. You know, permits have been approved, but there are still people trying to stop it, both the indigenous folks who are going to lose their native land, and there is a group of environmental lawyers who have taken this on board. The company which is trying to set the mine in motion, I believe, is having trouble financing the mine. You know, coal mining is becoming less and less profitable. It's becoming less and less acceptable. So I would like to predict that it won't go ahead, but I'm not sure because this is not my area. I'm not an economist. I don't know. But I'm certainly encouraging the federal government to withdraw those approvals. I'm encouraging the state government to withdraw those approvals. And I'm directly encouraging the mine itself to withdraw, to reconsider what they're doing, to consider that by selling those fossil fuels to other countries and allowing those countries to burn the fossil fuel is still directly killing the Great Barrier Reef. It is also directly killing other reefs around the world. And as I mentioned, that brings with it other humanitarian problems. So they need to think really hard about what they're doing in our world.
How long do we expect this current bleaching event to last?
It's beginning to finish now. So the waters around the reef are cooling down. So what we're seeing is less and less bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef. It's beginning to take off in other countries, as I mentioned, but if we concentrate on the Great Barrier Reef, the bleaching is beginning to stop. The water's dropping below 30 degrees centigrade, which is a critical threshold for many corals. And the bleaching has stopped. What happens now is that either the bleached coral recovers or it dies and seaweed takes over, algae takes over. And as I've mentioned a couple of times, it unfortunately looks like we're seeing a lot of algal growth. We're seeing a lot of seaweed taking over where normally coral would grow. And this is a competitive event. It's like, you know, plants competing in the forest canopy. But the algae is beginning to outcompete the coral. So what we'll end up with is a reef based on seaweed, not a reef based on corals. And corals support a lot more types of life than seaweed. And eventually, if the seaweed takes over, then the skeleton of the coral underneath breaks down and dissipates, and the actual structure of the reef will dissolve.
So once the seaweed takes over, then it's the end, basically.
It's not the end, but it is very difficult for the coral to come back. It's very difficult for it to outcompete that seaweed. And again, you know, getting back to some of the comments I've made, we need to give that coral its best possible opportunity to enter the competition again and push back against the seaweed and regrow the areas that it would naturally be found in.
As we go forward, what are you looking out for specifically to see the extent of the damage? Like, when will we know?
So there are a number of surveys underway right now. My colleagues from the James Cook University in Townsville are undertaking a very extensive underwater and flying over the reef survey. So if you tune into the Center for Coral Research at James Cook University, it's the center of excellence for coral reefs. Tune into their website, you'll see reports coming through right now. The Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority is also undertaking surveys. And within the coming months, they will return data and figures, and we'll find out what the extent is across the whole reef. And these are the sorts of figures that I hope the federal government will pay attention to and reverse their actions based on those figures, because, as I mentioned, I think they're going to be a lot worse than we initially predicted. But unfortunately, it does take months of people working. You know, the Great Barrier Reef is this huge structure. You can't just go outside and look at it. It's going to take months for those numbers to come through. By the time they're finalized, then the reef will be going, you know, one way or the other, and we need to do our best to help it go in the right direction.
Well, Justin Marshall, I wish we were speaking about happier news, and I hope this is a wake-up call to the sense of urgency that we need to have. Thanks for your work, and thanks for talking to us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the time, and thanks for listening, everyone who is listening. And, you know, please get out there and talk to people and do as much as you can about it.
That was my conversation with Justin Marshall, a professor at the University of Queensland and the founder of Coral Watch, a nonprofit where citizens are given tools to help monitor the health of coral reefs worldwide. Professor Marshall is also the co-author of the book, Coral Reefs and Climate Change. And that's it for The Elephant this time. The Elephant is made with support from the Climate Kick, that's KIC, Alumni Association. It's a community of entrepreneurs and young professionals working on creating a climate-resilient society. You can find out more at ckaa.eu. Our website is elephantpodcast.org, where you can find out how to get in touch with us and how to subscribe to the podcast. And to keep up to date, you can like our page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @elephantpodcast. I'm Kevin Caners. See you soon.